My name is Paul Menzel. I teach philosophy at Pacific Lutheran University. And one of the people I have found very, very interesting in the history of philosophy is Benedict Spinoza. And he also connects with some of the things I've heard discussed and talked about during the week, last 2 weeks here. So I'd just like to give you a little run-through. It's my version of just a few things about the life of this man and a few things about his general position and some reflections on the connections with Christian theological position. He has been called the God-intoxicated man in the history of philosophy. That's the label that is stuck on him, and you'll see why when I begin to develop his system. This is just food for thought. It's clear when you get into it that we're not expounding some father of Christian doctrine in any sense of the word at all. But nevertheless, I think that he is not only provocative for Christians, but is suggestive too, very suggestive at some point, and particularly suggestive for the modern age. Let me read just a couple of paragraphs from Bertrand Russell's A History of Western Philosophy. If you haven't read Bertrand Russell, he is one of the greatest writers in 20th century philosophy. Most of the rest of philosophers in the 20th century are extremely dull to read. But Bertrand Russell is one who's not. It's too bad that he's part of a past generation now. Spinoza, born in 1634. That's Russell's dating. Some other people put it at 1632, and there is some controversy about that. Is the noblest and most lovable of the great philosophers. I mean, this is in a book on the whole of Western philosophy. He calls him the noblest and most lovable of the great philosophers. Intellectually, some others have surpassed him, but ethically, he is supreme. As a natural consequence, he was considered, during his lifetime and for a century after his death, a man of appalling wickedness. He was born a Jew, but the Jews excommunicated him. Christians abhorred him equally, although his whole philosophy is dominated by the idea of God, and the Orthodox accused him of atheism. Leibniz, a subsequent philosopher, who owed much to him, concealed his debt and carefully abstained from saying a word in his praise. He even went so far as to lie about the extent of his personal acquaintance with this heretic Jew. The life of Spinoza was very simple. His family had come to Holland from Spain, or perhaps Portugal, to escape the Inquisition. He himself was educated in Jewish learning, but found it impossible to remain Orthodox. He was offered 1,000 florins a year to conceal his doubts. When refused, an attempt was made to assassinate him. When this failed, he was cursed with all the curses in Deuteronomy, and with the curse that Elisha pronounced on the children, who, in consequence, were torn to pieces by the she-bears. But no she-bears attacked Spinoza. He lived very quietly, first at Amsterdam, then at The Hague, making his living by polishing lenses. He eventually went partially blind from the dust of polishing lenses. His wants were few and simple. He showed throughout his life a rare indifference to money. The few who knew him loved him. The Dutch government, with its usual liberalism, tolerated his opinions on theological matters. At the age of 43, he died. Later on, just to summarize another thought, Russell says, Spinoza accepted from Descartes, the previous philosopher, and his contemporaries, a materialistic and totally deterministic physics, and sought within this framework to find room for reverence, a belief in God, and a life devoted to the good. His attempt was magnificent and rouses admiration even in those who do not think it successful. You can see that I'm not the only person who admires Spinoza and finds him suggestive. Well, what did this man say? Just one word about his major philosophical predecessor, René Descartes, about 40 years earlier. Descartes had said that there were three basic sorts of things in the world, three basic substances, he called them. God, the primary substance, and two secondary substances created by God, consciousness, or mind, and matter, or extension. Now, this was a rather revolutionary thing to say, to just divide the world up into consciousness and extent and matter. First of all, it was revolutionary to so highlight this business of mind with the adjective or the noun consciousness. That hadn't always been put on mind. We thought of minds as souls, which didn't always have to think. And Descartes gave some very interesting arguments for why consciousness and matter must be totally distinct from one another. As a result, Descartes had a problem. The problem was how to get mind and matter back together again, for one thing. Especially since, given the science of the day and given Descartes' own mathematical predilections, he was also a mathematician, Descartes had suggested, well, had argued strongly, that the material world was totally self-contained. Other than having been created by God, it could run on its own. And so for the first time, you had philosophically defended the independence of nature. Now, this is very disturbing to people. It raises, especially when you call mind consciousness. The problem then for Spinoza after Descartes really didn't see the problem. The problem was, well, what is God? Is God material? Is God conscious? Or what? God's supposed to be the creator of mind and matter. Spinoza found it difficult to believe that the ultimate substance, that which did not need creating, that was the definition of God, that which is totally non-dependent on anything else for its existence, was consciousness. He also found it puzzling to say that it was matter. At least in his day and age, he found it difficult. So what Spinoza did is say, well, God is just the ultimate principles about everything there is, and mind and matter are just two attributes of that thing, not two separate substances that are created by that thing, which then stand outside that entity. But they are just the unfolding of that entity. Mind and matter are just two unfolding attributes of God, the ultimate substance. Now, what is this ultimate substance? It is just the principles which do not themselves have any further explanation. Now, a modern analog of that, I think, would be to read nature as containing particular objects. Don has said, Don Kirk, for example, has said that he regards human beings as part of nature. And when they go about some particular behavior or espouse some belief, that's as much of a part of nature as anything else. Maybe a different part of nature, but it's part of nature. Well, whatever part of nature we're talking about, Spinoza would say, we're talking about a particular little segment which is developed out of the underlying principles of the universe. Whatever those underlying principles of the universe are, they are the ultimate determiner of everything that, of every particular thing that is, and every particular event in history. Now, those ultimate principles of nature, Spinoza just called God. He didn't think there was anything outside them. That is, they controlled, they determined every single thing that existed in the universe. There was nothing outside them, but they were not the particular thing. So Spinoza, in saying that nature is God, all of nature, consciousness and matter, is God, was not saying that my mind is God, nor that this rock is God. That would lead to crazy things like when the rock falls on me and kills me, I guess we'd have to say God killed me. Or if your emotion, in your mind, now we're talking about your mind, if you hate me, and somebody else loves me, we'd have to say God both loves and hates me, if we were to say God was everything there is, including you and him. But we don't want to say things like that. And Spinoza stressed that he wasn't saying things like that. God was no particular thing, but yet God was everything. God was the ultimate principles that out of which every single thing in the universe and all of nature and all of mind has developed. He also put some other things, some other descriptive attributes, adjectives on that. He called it nature as a whole. You got to get the notion of principles, the ordering principles of nature. That's what God is. He also called it self-creating. It's not created by anything else, and it continues to usher forth in all the things that are then part of it. Now, one of the nice things that this view of God does is that it doesn't get us into any puzzles about how God can remain infinite even though there's something outside of him. One of the traditional puzzles is, if God is truly infinite, how can there be a world outside him? And some traditional theologians have said, well, the world is therefore really a part of God somehow, but they've never been able to explain, reconcile that with the notion that God created the world. Well, for Spinoza, the world is the unfolding dimension of God. And he's not separate from it. He's infinite because he includes it. If he didn't include it, he wouldn't be infinite. So there's one little theological problem that's handled nicely by this. Another one that's handled nicely is, what is the whole business of God thinking? God doesn't need to think to create. There are ultimate principles of nature, and out of those the universe unfolds. And there's no thinking going on by God. Thinking is one of the things that unfolds from the ultimate principles of nature. Now, that's a remarkably 20th century attitude. It's a remarkably scientific attitude, and yet Spinoza was writing in the 1660 or so on this. You can already see why people can get excited about in the 20th century about reading this person. Now, very clearly, as a result of this, God is impersonal. I'll get to the implications of that in relation to love of God. Spinoza very clearly retained the notion of love of God, and that's, I think, the really interesting part of Spinoza. I'll get to that for a minute. Let's look at some of the other, at least one other interesting dimension of Spinoza's pantheism. Let's just frankly call it pantheism. Ultimately, nature, all of nature, is God. But nature, seen as a whole, and seen as self-creating, as unfolding, not seen as particular items in it. One consequence of this, Spinoza was very frank about it, is that if you believe in miracles, you're an atheist. That's what really got him in trouble with the Orthodox. it follows very clearly from his whole viewpoint that if you doubt that nature has within it the capacity to part the Red Sea, if in fact the Red Sea really did part, then you don't believe in God. You doubt that this, the ultimate principles of nature, can do something like that. For Spinoza's God, then, defined in Spinoza's terms, would be doubted by you. You would disbelieve in that God if you believed that there was no natural explanation of the parting of the Red Sea. Now, clearly something can still appear to be a miracle to us simply because we don't understand nature, but ultimately there are no miracles. And anybody who believes ultimately there are miracles is doubting the sufficiency of this, of these ultimate principles that explain why there are things and order the things that are in this world. Let's pick up now, I think, the more personal and the theological elements in Spinoza. Spinoza talked very explicitly about uniting ourselves to God. One impression you may get so far is that, well, this is pantheism. This is nature is God, or the ultimate principles that out of which nature emerge, the particular things in nature emerge, and God doesn't think, and God is impersonal, so how can human beings relate to God? Most people have thought that if you're a pantheist or if you're sort of one of these first creation deists, God creates the world and lets it alone after that, and maybe God didn't even create it consciously, God is another impersonal being, that
human beings don't have any relationship to God.
Well, Spinoza was very different, and this is his really creative part. Remember, God is nature creating itself as a whole. It's the ultimate principles of nature. By the way, a modern analog might be unified field theory. We try to get down to something that's ultimate in the explanation of things. Is that really any different than God? Does the role of unified field theory in contemporary physics play really that much different a role in explaining what the universe is and why it's here than the theological function of God, at least? There's some parallels, at least. Spinoza would say they're more than parallels. It really is the same sort of thing. God is nature as a whole. When we unite ourselves with God, we are simply seeing nature as a whole. So whenever we understand the place of particular things in the whole natural system and the emergence of particular things out of that whole system, we are seeing things as God would see them. Now God, because God is not a finite thing, doesn't have consciousness. And so God never really sees them in the sense that we think of see them. But the ultimate general principles of order out of which nature emerges obviously work comprehensively. They wouldn't be principles of order if they didn't work comprehensively. So to see things comprehensively is to do as much as human beings can do, given that they are conscious entities, to become like God. That is then uniting ourselves with God. Now, that may still look rather odd, but then Spinoza starts talking not only about uniting ourselves with God, but about loving God. In understanding the place of something in nature as a whole, you're coming to see it from a godlike perspective, and you come to a greater reverence of the ultimacy and awe and wonder of that ultimate principle or ultimate principles of nature. And you then revere that and you have joy in it. And you love it. So you begin to get a whole personal response to that, which Spinoza then talks very frankly about the love of God, about joy in God, about reverence for God, etc. But he does say still some very heretical things from the Orthodox viewpoint, like a man who loves God cannot want God to love him. Because if you understand what God is, you would not want God to love you. You would love God, but you would not want God to love you. As I said, that's obviously what got him defined as a heretic by, that's one of the things that got him defined as a heretic by both Jewish and Christian tradition. Now, let's apply this notion of uniting ourselves with God in terms of understanding the place of things in nature as a whole to something like sin or any blameworthy action. Spinoza said the origin of all wrong action is simply failure to understand. It's intellectual error. Somebody gets mad at something. They get mad and angry and revengeful or whatever it is, and they do bad things because they don't understand the place of the thing they're reacting to in the universe. If they understood it, they wouldn't get mad at it. If you understand, you will not sin. Furthermore, in looking at somebody else's sin, if you understand the origin of that sin, you will not sin against that sin, because you will understand how that sin came about. You will understand how the lack of understanding came about. And then you will not sin on top of it. This is all because of the determinism, the radical determinism in Spinoza's system. Everything is determined. Ignorance is determined, knowledge is determined, sin is determined, good deeds are determined, And it all flows from the ultimate, they all flow from the ultimate principles of nature. Now, part of that is, of course, that good and evil are only attributes we put on things from a human point of view. There's no good and evil from God's point of view. That's a human dimension. And so when you label something good or evil, is it even just evil? When you label something evil, that's a peculiarly humanly created attribute. Now, as you understand the place of the evil thing more, you begin to drop those attributes. Spinoza explicitly emphasized, I think with a striking parallel here, this biblical phrase. Well, at least interpreters say he did. I don't know enough about the original text here to know whether which particular words were left in. Let us put all of them in for now. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Becomes the central explanatory principle, the central regulatory principle about human behavior. Father, forgive them. It's not just Father, forgive them. Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And Father, forgive me, for I may not know what I'm doing. That is, I don't see the place of this action I'm reacting against and my motivations in reacting against it in the whole picture of things, in the whole universe. I said maybe some of those words should be dropped. Maybe what the only part of the biblical injunction he would preserve, maybe he would drop the first word and say, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Depends whether you imagine Spinoza addressing God and doing this. Now, since he kept notions like joy in the presence of God, joy, love of God, and reverence for God, I doubt if he would have retracted the Father, the word the Father. So he probably shared a lot more here with the biblical tradition than his critics thought. And, I mean, if you want to look at an explanation of that phrase, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, where in traditional theology do you find as good an explanation of what that means and why it's there as you do in Spinoza's system? I doubt if you do find a better one. Now, all that, of course, would be said about in relation to yourself as well as in relation to other people. When you were angry, you would not, or sad, or crushed, you would not shut yourself up in your own world of sorrow. The first thing is you would try to understand. It's the first thing you're obligated to do. Try to understand. When you understand it, it may not go away, but you don't waste energy reacting to it. And that gets to another notion in Spinoza. When you understand, he says, you have active emotions instead of passive emotions. You have, that is, emotions that somehow emerge out of your distinctive qualities as a human being with understanding, rather than just flowing from the happenstance events of things, in which case emotions are often wasteful and destructive of the very person that has them. That's why he called them passions. They don't reflect any freedom of the individual. They reflect a being buffered about by the forces of the universe. Consequently, part of the energies of the person are drained. That terrible feeling we have in us when we go through a very emotional experience, that we are being drained. Spinoza says that doesn't happen if you understand what's going on. If you understand your emotions, you do not feel drained. There may be very other intense feelings, but you do not feel any of you has been taken away. So your liberation is increased, your sense of liberation, self-determination, all within a perfectly determined world is increased. That's the remarkable combination that Spinoza has come up with. Now, as I've implied by talking about the love of God in Spinoza's system, I think there is a place for a kind of worship in Spinoza's own life, certainly a sense of awe. One may wonder how one can have a sense of awe and wonder about an entity, ourselves or another person, or a particular flower in nature, if it wasn't at all consciously designed or created, because it's not in Spinoza's system. But for Spinoza, I mean, it's just absolutely wondrous that all this emerges out of a totally uncreated, independent thing, if you want to call it that, principle in the universe, that which has no creator itself, which by any standard, I think, would be called God, some sort of. Now, what I've held out to people in the public relations title was announced at noon is heretic or prophet. Maybe you've gotten some of that flavor already. Obviously, Spinoza's a heretic. You shouldn't have said whore. It's a question of whether he's also a prophet. Maybe I would retract the clear statement that he's a heretic. One interesting question would be, can some of the doctrines in Christianity be reinterpreted so that they're compatible with Spinoza's system? Why would one want to do that? Why would one even raise that question? Well, again, one has to look at the initial attractiveness of Spinoza's system. It's very attractive in an age, a modern age, in which people have difficulty wondering how that which creates matter can itself be mental. Wouldn't it, God, somehow have to be material? This is the 20th century physiological point of view. Wouldn't God have to have a brain to think? Would be the simplest way to put it. And we get in puzzles about that. Spinoza just clears all those problems out of the way. Maybe there are other problems left, but he does clear those problems out of the way. And in that sense, I think, is very suggestive. The other way in which he's particularly suggestive is he starts to link that with some ethical convictions. As Russell so clearly sees, Spinoza is not primarily just an intellectual philosopher. He's a person who wants to map out an explanation for why people should live a certain way. And Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do, is finally, I think, the central maxim. That's, at least as commentators, we could phrase Spinoza's whole ethic by that phrase. And in a world in which there's a lot of emphasis on the scientific point of view, it seems to me worthwhile explaining how you can get an ethical injunction, forgive people, out of a naturalistic, exclusively naturalistic viewpoint. Now, as I said, I've made no attempt to claim that Spinoza's to really argue that Spinoza's not a heretic. I have no attempt to suggest that any of us should be adopt or come close to adopting this viewpoint, but I do think it's very interesting. I'm not a Spinoza scholar, so I don't know what all the texts are, but in the commentaries I've read and just the Ethics, which is his main philosophical work, he doesn't reveal his colors on it. He seems to imply that Jesus was a very great prophet, and he certainly implies that. But what more he might have believed about Jesus, we don't know. I don't know. Nor do the commentaries and secondary sources seem to address that problem. He did write at length about biblical interpretation. And he wrote, he argued at length for a non-literal interpretation of Scripture. And that got him in trouble with his own Jewish. He might. His ethics are so strikingly Christian in the very fundamental, simple sense of gospel ethics, it seems to me, that Sermon on the Mount ethics, that, you know, it would be surprising if, having studied the New Testament, he didn't make a little more of Jesus than the standard Jewish tradition.
It seems to me that he really takes his base though from Judaism, Christianity, with his great appreciation for the love of God without a demand for a caring, overseeing, sustaining God who personally loves man. And in that sense, the Christian often wonders why is the Jew so able to serve God and respect God and revere God, and God is in some sense, at least not from our background, more impersonal, less attainable, more other. This is what he's really sort of retained from his...
Except the Jewish tradition has a lot of variety within it.
Oh, yeah.
Within it, too. And certainly Spinoza's God is not a Jewish God, because the Jewish God is may not be... It may be personal in a different sense than our usual picture of the Christian God, but it certainly is... it seems to be a person. There are all kinds of personal attributes. God feels righteousness. I think God would be a...
The thing we recognize as of Spinoza's writing as being common to our faith are the Hebrew components of it.
Rather than the Christian God. Yes.
Nothing new that's Christian that he espoused. The parts he espoused are the parts we've taken from Judaism too.
Except this, Father forgive them, but they know not what they do, which is, I think, the best summary of his ethics that there is. You don't get that out of standard. In the standard Jewish tradition.
You made the comment when you were saying that you weren't sure that he would leave the Father in. Like, Father forgive them so they know not what to do. Doesn't it strike you that it's illogical for him to put Father in there if he's saying that it's impossible for God to love man because God is merely the principles and the created man, which man loves the principles that have created him. In other words, he's asking something that's totally indifferent to understand. When he's saying Father, he's obviously not appealing to anything personal.
But there's always the problem about what human attributes applied to God mean. There's that problem in the Christian tradition. When we apply an attribute to God, like Father, do we mean an analog of the human notion of Father? Or do we mean an actual loving, consciously loving Father? All attributes get changed somehow when they're taken from human context and applied to God. And people just differ a lot on how much they get changed. There may be, you know, a sense in which, even for Spinoza, God is Father. Certainly he's creator.
That same passage is kind of puzzling to me. If understanding is supposed to stay wrath and vengeance and so forth, why the plea to the understander of all? Why is it put in the form of a plea like that to forgive them?
That's why maybe we would remove the... Maybe the address is not to Father, but to God, but the address... But yet Spinoza emphasized very clearly this intellectual love of God. And the intellectual love of God is not just, it's not an undirected love. It's the love of some thing in reality or dimension of reality, what God, which to Spinoza was nature operating in its fundamental principles as a whole and creating itself. It seems like he can't address, if he emphasizes so much the love of God as he does, he says, you know, increasing your understanding. Anytime you understand the world better, what you're really doing is loving God. There's an object of the love. So why couldn't there be an addressing of sorts? It wouldn't be an addressing, but maybe it doesn't fit here because God doesn't forgive.
Well, it's not just the addressing, or the act of addressing that I was puzzled about, but why he's asking God to forgive when As if he was about to bring forth vengeance of some sort, when he wouldn't, in understanding, according to that system.
Well, if he could be, if he were addressing a whole community, and he understands that a whole community's response to a situation, whether it be vengeful or forgiving or what, is itself going to follow from, because he's a determinist, follow from the workings of nature, that includes our mind. And it's certainly not in Spinoza's hands. Spinoza by forgiveness can't influence it. You know, he makes this plea. It's a totally ineffectual plea. But he might address it to God, since he has notions like love of God, meaning the operations of nature, since the operation, the actions of other human beings against or towards somebody are the operations of nature. So I think we could perhaps extrapolate still a sense to addressing this, forgive them for they know not what they do, to his own God. But I admit clearly it's strained.
I kind of got the impression when you were talking earlier that more of the point of saying that forgive them for they know not what they do was in line with ethics of how we dealing with the conflicts with each other, sins against each other. In other words, that's sort of like what we do or should do, realize that the other person doesn't understand what they're doing. I mean, rather than, I mean, for myself, okay, I can say, well, I can apply that in the Christian sense, but if you take away the Father, simply to apply it in a different setting, to problems that we have with others. Is that part of what he's saying?
Yeah, it's primarily forgive them for they know not what what they do. But then you look at the use.
When you say instead of reacting emotionally and draining yourself, if you're having an understanding, or I had another question there too, and that was, and what his ideas there. Did he feel it was possible for us to understand the whole picture enough, to understand where we were coming from and where the other person was coming from in the whole picture?
Yes.
Do you understand my question?
Yes, it is possible. If you just try, it's possible. And even if you don't fill in the concrete elements in the explanation, mm-hmm. Spinoza still has a faith. There is an explanation.
Well, that's
and therefore, the person is, should be forgiven anyhow, even if we don't know it.
If you don't understand, you accept that you don't understand that there's an understanding
right.
that could be had.
The other comment about this, Father, forgive them for they know not what to do, is to look at what the Christian meaning of that is. It's odd indeed that if Christians have a loving and forgiving God, that they have to ask God to forgive people because those people know not what they do. And so maybe the meaning within a Christian context of Father, forgive them for they know not what they do is not to request something of God, but to emphasize, Father, I'm shouting now, pleading with the whole world, forgive them for they know not what they do. I'm not sure what... all the context in which, well, clearly we could just tick off the context in which people say that. And I'm not sure that the context in which people, in which Christians say that, are ones in which they think God would not forgive. And they're pleading with God. I mean, that doesn't make much sense to me. So.
Could you say something about his thought in terms of the words good and evil? What is good for Spinoza? What is evil? Is evil a disorganization or creation or something that would change it from what it has been?
Seem to be two operating definitions of it. One is, good is that which gets you closer to God, that is, closer to a level of reality in which there are connections, including connections of understanding. Remember, consciousness or understanding is only one aspect of reality, thought. It's another attribute of the flip side of the, what is also material. I lost my train of thought for a minute.
good.
In the digression.
That's just good. What gets you closer to?
What gets you closer to God?
Yeah.
Is what's good. And what's bad is what gets you further down in the level of particular things and away from this comprehensive love, which if we're talking about consciousness means you fail to understand, or if you're talking about the evil of a conscious state, or...
So goodness can be reduced just to a better understanding without any change in any material arrangement?
Well, it would be, because material... He thinks that a better understanding is going to have its flip side in some material events.
The other operating definition of good and evil is to know that it's self-preservation. Again, Cooper brings out how he said it has been labeled a naturalist. Good for human beings is what enables them to survive. Now, Spinoza said that what in fact will enable them to survive is understanding. Because that will dampen wasteful emotions. So that if the two notions merge, but they wouldn't initially, they might think of two definitions of good and evil operating. But it's clear that it's very clear that God cannot be attributed terms like good and evil. God does not attribute those terms to anything else. God is not only unconscious and impersonal, but he's just totally disconnected from the attributes of the universe. Which immediately clearly sees why, for Spinoza's God, there is no problem with evil. It's a human creation. Problem with evil, strictly human creation. No, he's just assuming whatever ultimate principles of nature there are, he doesn't understand what they are God. But he calls those principles God. There you go. And supposes that they are one. He can't imagine that the ultimate principles of nature come from different sources. How could that be? They'd have to be different creators. Well, I suppose it could be. At that point, I think you see a real element of faith in Spinoza. We could trace it either to an emotional faith that there is one infinite God, and yes, what that might be, it would have to be include nature. Or we could, I guess philosophically, you might not start there. You might just start with a definition. He took the medieval and Cartesian definition of substance, which is that which does not depend on anything else. Which is ran from there. But no, he doesn't know what those principles are. But, I mean, that's just a confession of humility about the nature of God.
A lot of philosophers deal with man's attempt to relate to a God or find some ultimate principle and begin their whole systems in that way. Does he feel that kind of uniform search of man for a creator is just a search of man's search for a better understanding? This is a good thing and built into the universe.
I would suppose so.
If there's any struggle for this relationship, it's just one of better understanding, more education. That's a good thing.
Well, it may not be more education. Education may not enable you to see the place in things as a whole.
Right.
And that, therefore, would not be understanding. A lot of modern education.
Did he write this in the form of
a,
I mean, what did he, how did he
express these? Oh, well, I mean, I'm not going to point you to a book because his writing is a very obtuse and strange indeed.
Is it?
His major book is called simply The Ethics. It includes all the pantheism stuff, too. And he wrote everything as proof. He started with certain premises and definitions, and then he has axioms and definitions, and then he has the demonstration of the intermediate step, and finally the demonstration of the theorem, and then he has corollaries, and it's incredibly cumbersome and strange to read.
Is
this
sort of a pre-runner
of
process philosophy?
Some of the process, Whitehead explicitly acknowledges that, but Dave Knudsen here is probably better than that. What process theologians have revered Spinoza?
I can't even answer that question very well, but I think in some sense, yes, because the idea of nature self-creating is also an idea that's kind of process philosophy. Helping our Whitehead system, well, depending on how you argue, some people would say that God is really not a necessary term in Whitehead system, because we're really talking about a whole process in nature which has self-transcending aspects to it, enduring objects in it, and so on. And so I think there are some affinities there about that process. Of course, what's more of an emphasis at the time? The development of specific occasions in nature and what goes into those, if they analyze those, and the process philosophy sees the world very much in dynamic terms. I think the dynamic terms are there for the inherent, and most of them are not developed that much. And that's potential to doing that. But perhaps he's too much of an inheritor of the Middle Age.
The translation of the term for God usually is nature as a whole creating itself.
Mm-hmm. That's where I'm not going to talk around. I was going to say, too, it seems to me that there are some interesting affinities with even Orthodox and classical theology here, in the sense that I think theologians from the very outset, after the biblical period, were trying to find how do you reconcile two things. On the one hand, the uncreated being, which is the way in which the early church fathers talked about God, the uncreated one. How you relate that to, you know, particular beings, and of course in Christian tradition, the Logos that becomes flesh, which is particular to humans. And theologians often had a certain appreciation for the infinity of God, final mystery of God, God as being born. I think all those things have a certain connection. The other side of it, I think, as you were pointing out, is that in Christian theology, we've always had, going back to the Hebraic root, God as purpose and will, which is moral will. And that's what you don't need to know. Moral will is there.
Any other comments? Well, we're not confined to a physics. One way or the other, yes.
Husband White, Bertrand Russell calls him noble. Is it because of what he saw, or is it because of the obsession to find out the truth, or is it because of his lifestyle, or is it because what he thought determined how he lived, or is it because he was
I think all those things, but perhaps especially given the other darts that Russell throws at other philosophers in the book, Hume and Leibniz particularly, probably the fact that Spinoza did not try to be popular. He just simply did his thing, and a few people noticed, and he got condemned. then later, 100 years later, he really began to be appreciated. Except by Leibniz, who appreciated him all along but never admitted. Now, we don't have a lot about this person. We don't have the volume about him and by him that we have in the case of others. So maybe this is all a myth. Maybe Spinoza really wasn't like this. You could go digging. I'm not a scholar.